We promised you a moment, one shining moment, when everything changed in college sports. And the truth is, we kind of lied. There's more than one, but if you had to pick, and I'm told we do, well, hold my beer, George Orwell, because we are going to 1984. This is The Option, Episode 2, Pocket Pressure. 1984 was a good, weird year. We got Ghostbusters, Terminator, Karate Kid. We got Born in the USA, Like a Virgin, Run DMC, Bird and Magic playing in the finals, Montana and Marino in the Super Bowl. And even in college, we're talking epic, all-time stuff.
It's the confrontation we've been waiting for. The bruising battle of the big men for the 1984 National Championship.
Future Hall of Famers Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon going at it. Like I said, pretty good. But I did say weird, and 1984 was definitely weird. We also got Gremlins, Purple Rain, Temple of Doom, Walter Mondale. And college football got awfully weird that year, too. BYU was the consensus national champion after coming back to beat Michigan.
12, 11, 10, 9. Oh, boy. Brigham Young University has won the Holiday Bowl 24-17. And the Cougars are the only undefeated team in the nation. And I think they'll be number one.
Now, look. The Holiday Bowl was not, and is not today, now called the San Diego County Credit Union Holiday Bowl at Petco Park, an especially prestigious event. However, in 1984, it was enough. The second-ranked Oklahoma Sooners blew the Orange Bowl against the Washington Huskies, leaving a clear path for the undefeated BYU Cougars. And you want to know what it is that makes BYU unique among national champions?
I am a Mormon! The Mormon just believes.
No, not that. Although, yeah, also that. But no, what I was going to say was they were the first national champion to come from outside a major conference. And they are also the last team to do so. So cheers, with water, to the 84 Cougars. But what's a major conference anyways? Sounds arbitrary, doesn't it?
The major conferences in the NCAA are the Power Five conferences. The NCAA lingo for them is Autonomy Five.
Amanda Kristovich is a reporter at Front Office Sports, where she spends a lot of time on the business of college sports.
So the SEC, the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, and the Pac-12. Those are the five richest conferences in the NCAA. They are also the best conferences at football, and they're the ones that have the most voting power in the NCAA structure, which is where the autonomy phrase comes from.
When BYU won the title in 1984, the Cougars played in the Western Athletic Conference, usually referred to as the WAC, no offense, which is decidedly not a major. After that, BYU joined the Mountain West Conference. Again, not a major, though stay tuned. Then they broke away and went independent for a while, and last year they joined the Big 12. The Big 12 is a Power 5 conference. It's a major, but it's a major in serious flux. BYU is one of eight schools joining either this year or last. And that wouldn't be happening if the Big 12 wasn't also losing schools, as the Power 5 turns more and more into a Power 2.
Big 12 announcing Texas and Oklahoma have agreed in principle to leave the conference and move to the SEC.
Oklahoma and Texas will become members of the SEC. It is a colossal move in the world of college football.
Now, why would they go and do that? Since when is Texas part of the Southeast? There's A&M, I guess. Still weird, but probably an isolated incident.
College football is officially turned upside down. USC and UCLA officially announced they will be joining the Big Ten.
The Big Ten is getting bigger, and it's going out west.
It's going to change the landscape.
All right, you got me there. Maybe the better question is, since when is Los Angeles in the Midwest? And the all-consuming Big Ten didn't stop there. By the end of this year, they'll really be the Big 18.
The University of Oregon and the University of Washington have officially left the Pac-12. They'll be joining the Big Ten Conference.
Makes you wonder, are they also moving Nike and the Space Needle? Some of these moves don't even make sense, and yet they do. Because they make something better than sense. They make dollars, and lots of them. And wouldn't you know it, that comes back to 1984, too. We mentioned Oklahoma earlier, and while Barry Switzer's Sooners did not win the national title that year, they did score a different kind of win, with a key contribution from the bench.
We'll hear arguments first this morning in National Collegiate Athletic Association against the Board of Regents of the University of Oklahoma.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
That's Andy Coates there. He argued on behalf of the University of Oklahoma and found himself before the Supreme Court making a big claim. The NCAA had a monopoly, specifically a broadcast monopoly.
The NCAA bylaws, which control the televising of college football games and the exclusive network contracts, which should govern the sale of these rights, are classic violations of the Sherman Act.
And this is Andy Coates today.
One of my partners who had also argued in the Supreme Court says, now, Andy, the problem is you always want to try to be funny, and you can't be funny among the Supreme Court. You can't be amusing. Well, one of the early questions was,
mostly in the basis of local and regional circumstances.
So long as Oklahoma's on every Saturday.
Well, it would be hoped, Your Honor, that the networks would want us. If we don't do better than we did last year, they may not. But that would certainly be the hope.
Unfortunately, everybody kind of smiled and laughed at that, so it kind of broke the tension and it was an easier thing.
Coates won two arguments that day. First, you can be funny at the Supreme Court. And second, a landmark case about broadcast rights. For a long time, the NCAA alone decided whose games aired on TV and how often. Eventually, the football powerhouses got pretty fed up with that. Pretty sure that they'd be able to get more national exposure and, yes, more money if they could make their own media deals. So Coates argued, successfully, that the NCAA could not legally limit Oklahoma's access to the broadcast market. And once that happened, college football soared.
We knew there was a great desire out there for people to watch college football, but I don't think anybody predicted that it would be what it was. And in fact, the colleges lost money over the previous years, the first two or three years after this decision came out. But then it began to pick up steam and conferences began to realign and coaches started making lots and lots of money. And I think that's what has driven the changes, which are unfortunate.
In the end, Coates in Oklahoma won that case, and only two justices dissented, one of whom was Byron White. And if you're not familiar, he was the type of guy who led the NFL in rushing yards while also attending Yale Law School. Super unimpressive dude.
And Justice White, who was maybe one of the most amazing guys I've ever known, he asked several questions, and I could tell I wasn't going to get him, probably. And in fact, it's interesting, I was at a function with him probably 3 or 4 months after we had done the argument. And he said to me, sort of in passing, he says, Andy, he says, you may win that case, he says, but you'll regret it. And I thought that he had a better vision about what the future was like than the rest of us did.
Justice White was proven right over the last 40 years or so. Board of Regents opened a cash valve that has not shut since, as economist Andy Zimbalist explains here.
The 84 Supreme Court decision in Board of Regents was a watershed moment. Basically, what it did is it said that the NCAA television has to operate on a commercial basis. It can't be controlled anymore by the NCAA. They're behaving as an illegal monopoly. And once it opened that up, then the conferences started to rejigger themselves to maximize their television market and to maximize their television revenues. And that's been happening ever since. That's what's driving the system.
That system and the whole pay structure within it just wasn't the same back in the 80s. It's not to say that schools weren't already making money off football and using it to bankroll athletic departments. They were, and they still are. But the shortest way to put this is that everything about college football, the good and the bad, just wasn't nearly as big. And it's all about TV, big money on the small screen. Amanda Kristovich from Front Office Sports once again.
TV is absolutely driving the bus. Absolutely. And TV is the reason that there is such a weird conflict in college sports now about the idea of amateurism, pre-professional sports that bring in just as much, if not more, than most of the major professional sports. That's what makes it look professional, is because of the billions of dollars that are coming in.
As we talked about last time, though, the money that goes into a college athletic department must go back out. It needs an outlet. And as the pile has gotten bigger overall, it's gone to all kinds of crazy stuff. State-of-the-art facilities, yes, but the biggest annual expenses, the easiest way to get this cash out the door, is by using it to lure top coaches. Coaching pay has exploded, as pointed out by perpetual sleeve monster victim Pat McAfee going into the 2022 season.
Nick Saban has agreed to a new deal. It's been renegotiated. He is now getting paid $11.7 million. He has a deal in which anytime a new contract is done in the SEC or in coaching as a whole, and it bumps him out of the top three average in coaching annual salary, he is to renegotiate.
It's a totally different landscape than the one we had 40 years ago. And much of that comes back to Board of Regents. Take Barry Switzer as an example, since we're talking about Oklahoma so much already. He was larger than life, and all his off-the-field stuff aside, he was inarguably one of the most successful coaches ever. Three national titles, including 85.
This will do it. The capper on a national championship season for the Sooners of Oklahoma. Oklahoma, 25. Penn State, 10. And Coach Switzer goes out a victor and a national championship coach.
That year, all in, he was making somewhere on the order of $300,000, which is more like $850 in today's dollars. Nothing to scoff at by any means. He's got me beat. But that was for a three-time national champ, more than a decade into his career, one of the biggest names in the sport ever. Oklahoma's coach now is leading the Sooners in his first head coaching gig.
Brent Venables, longtime Clemson defensive coordinator, will become Oklahoma's new head coach.
I'm just thankful to be here. As y'all know, I'm the new head coach at Oklahoma, but I'm not new to Oklahoma.
Don't get me wrong, this is not your average first-timer. Venables brought a sterling resume to the job, including prior experience in Norman. But he makes $7 million a year, and that annual salary barely cracks the top 20 in the sport. We are long past the point of keeping pace with inflation, and this kind of money is even going to coaches when they're leaving jobs.
Every year, 10 or so FBS football coaches are fired, their staffs are let go.
That's Amy Perko, the CEO of the Knight Commission, probably the best known of all the groups that make reform recommendations to the NCAA.
Those severance pay agreements have tripled since the college football playoff began. Just last year, we saw, the severance pay approached, I believe it was $100 million.
And we talked to Amy last year, so those are 2022 numbers. In 2023, that figure hit $200 million. These aren't golden parachutes. They're platinum, and it's all part of the same arms race.
Football coaching salaries have, in many cases, doubled the rate of growth, athlete scholarships. And in many cases, triple. Of the 52 public Power 5 schools that we have data for, those schools are going to be spending $1.4 billion on 575 football coaches by 2030. They're going to be spending more money on those 575 football coaches than those same schools put into athlete scholarships and financial benefits for more than 30,000 college athletes. That to us is, just evidence of a model that's not in alignment with what college sports is supposed to be about.
So that's what the coaches are getting, and nobody seems too thrilled with that. Pretty much everyone, with the possible exception of coaches themselves, would say, yeah, we could probably Robin Hood those guys a bit. Most reformers would like to see some of this money find its way to athletes one way or another. And let's be clear, some money is. It can feel weird to put it this way, given the whole debate, but college athletes are already paid with something. This has been the NCAA's position forever. Athletes get scholarships to attend the university, which, ask anyone sending their kids to college or still paying down their own student debt, is no small matter. That is serious six-figure money at a lot of schools, and we can't just dismiss that. Nor should we ignore the progress that's been made in the last decade, because all too recently, even college athletes on a full-ride scholarship, and to be clear, most college athletes are not, didn't always have money for basic needs.
beat as student athletes get utilized for what we do so well. And we definitely, we're definitely best to get a scholarship to our universities. But at the end of the day, that doesn't cover everything. You know, we do have hungry nights that we don't have enough money to get food in. Sometimes, money is needed.
That's Shabazz Napier, the star point guard for a title-winning UConn Huskies team back in 2014.
I don't think you student athletes should get hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, there are hungry nights that I go to bed and I'm starving. So something can change, something should change.
His comments made national news for a week, as everyone was rightly outraged that the MVP of March Madness went without meals that season. Outraged and also confused, because the rules just seemed bizarre. These were the basics, as explained at the time, by the Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman.
There are rules about what each athletic program can feed athletes, and that's basically because they essentially don't want others to have competitive advantages. Some have lavish spreads and others don't. And so the rules are basically you can feed athletes one so-called training table meal a day, where it's sort of like all you can eat. And then after that, it's somewhat patchwork. You can feed them around competitions and vacations, things like that, but there are gaps.
And this may seem like a weird place to put your foot down on competitive balance, and it is. But this, too, comes back to money. Schools with smaller budgets didn't want to compete with the biggest budgets on the sheer cost of food. But the Napier episode forced a common sense change. Responding to the backlash, the NCAA got serious about providing meals, yes, but also something called full cost of attendance. Schools adopted measures to offer stipends to college athletes for all living expenses, so that situations like Napier's could be avoided, and some of the most pedantic NCAA penalties could be done away with.
I think one of the good moves that the NCAA has made is to eliminate some restrictions of what we can provide student athletes.
That's Jamie Gordon. He's the new head of the American Volleyball Coaches Association, so we'll hear more from him again later. But before that, he was the AD at Morehead State.
From things like meals and entertainment and just things that overall enhance their collegiate experience and to be able to manage things. Cost of attendance being a big one. The athletes now are provided, almost every imaginable advantage from a training standpoint. When you think about nutritionists, sports psychologists, strength coaches that are traveling, culture coaches, all of this stuff.
These are all real positives for college athletes, as were moves mainly in the Power Five to guarantee scholarships for 4 years. Put that all together, and the college athlete experience is just better today than it was in decades past. That is a good thing. But since it's true across the board, one of the trickier things to unravel here is the fact that much of the money generated by football and basketball has also gone to other sports. Not on the same scale, but for the Olympic sports programs, most of which don't generate much money of their own, the expenses are high and in a lot of the same areas. Coaching, resources, facilities.
Pac-12 track and field, the conference where I am. The Pac-12 track and field championships each spring are like a mini Olympics.
Victoria Jackson teaches at Arizona State after her own career as a track and field athlete there and at UNC.
And actually, in the year 2022, the University of Oregon hosted the Pac-12 Track and Field Championships, the NCAA Track and Field Championships, the USA Track and Field Championships, which were qualifying for Worlds, and then they hosted the World Championships for Track and Field in Little Eugene, Oregon. So, like, the world understands that the best facilities for Olympic sports are at American universities. It also helps when Phil Knight builds a $270 million track and field stadium on your campus and, like, in the middle of campus.
Now, obviously, they're not going to tear down the stadium no matter what the next few years hold. But there is a genuine question to ask there in terms of how to bring expenses back down to earth when and if the cash flow gets diverted.
A lot of that spending was also happening in the Olympic sports because the business of college sports isn't making money, it's spending money. And if the media rights increase and if the college football playoff monies increase and more of that money stays with the richest conferences, they got to spend that money, especially if they don't want to share it with the athletes generating that money. And so coaches' salaries in the Olympic sports have gone up dramatically. The budgets for Olympic sports have gone up dramatically. that's unsustainable. And from my perspective, that's money that should have been staying with football players.
Victoria's all for it, but I'm sure she would tell you herself, actually executing on that kind of redistribution would not be universally popular in all matters of politics. And this is political, all right. Taking something away is the hardest thing to do. And they would be taking it from sports that are already not as well-funded as football and basketball, because no one is. That would be rough. And even where you wouldn't anticipate the sort of blowback that that could get, the NCAA has always taken some kind of public pressure or legal nudge, sometimes a shove, to make a change. So right now, everybody's waiting to see if the next big shove might take us over the edge, because the Alston decision robbed the NCAA of a key foothold. One they first set down back in, you guessed it, Board of Regents in 1984. Here's basketball analyst Jay Billis again, putting on his attorney hat.
And the NCAA lost that case. The schools won. But in that case was some dicta, as is referred to in the law. It wasn't part of the ruling, but it was part of the opinion. And it was just a simple recitation of facts. And one of those facts was an NCAA principle that said athletes shall not be paid. It was just a recitation of the amateurism principle. There was zero ruling and nothing with force of law behind the amateurism principle in the Board of Regents case. But other courts, lower courts, in years after, the NCAA was able to rely upon that dicta, and courts, in my opinion, incorrectly used that to thwart off a number of claims against the NCAA for compensation by players in later years.
To hear it from Billis and others, the NCAA could have taken the relatively favorable ruling they got on Alston in the Ninth Circuit. It ordered schools to pay up on education-related benefits, which would have been real money, yeah, but nothing catastrophic. Nothing like the bill that might come due now that they pushed their luck one appeal farther.
By taking the Alston case to the United States Supreme Court, the NCAA was risking all that. And they rolled the dice and they came up snake eyes and lost. And they lost every protection they had in the Board of Regents case. The Supreme Court in the Alston case came, basically said, no more. Like, this was dicta, it has no force of law, and it's not to be considered anymore.
It's kind of like they were playing Mario Kart and they had their little invincibility star for going on 40 years, and then the music stopped. Now, you might look around today and see all this mounting legal jeopardy and think, well, hey, the game's up, guys. You had a good run, but now you got to reel it back, start planning for a different kind of future. But it should not surprise you to learn that the immediate future is also a lot more money, with one key caveat. When we talk about all this money, you might be under the impression that much of the big bucks find their way to the NCAA itself. And that's not really the case, not for the most part, because one of the NCAA's main jobs is to run championships for all the sports. With one notable exception, the CEO of the Knight Commission, Amy Perko.
A lot of folks don't know this. It's probably one of the most misunderstood facts in college sports, but the college football playoff does not send any money to the NCAA. The college football playoff is a separate LLC, and the money that's generated through that playoff goes directly to the schools. And yet the NCAA is still the organization that's liable for the sport of SBS football on a national basis. The NCAA still handles all of the litigation through its March Madness revenues for the sport of football. And so there's a real, you know, if you were going to build a model, I don't think there's any strategic business consultant that would build the model we currently have.
And given that football is what makes the college sporting world go around, that puts the NCAA in something of a tenuous position. Starting with 1984 and granting football greater and greater independence, the NCAA has slowly relinquished its control over the sport that pays all the bills.
Now they're in this interesting kind of bind. They've lost the courts. They're hoping they don't lose Congress, but they're in real danger of losing the serious money makers for the NCAA, the top dogs.
That's Sarah Fields. She studies the intersection of sport and culture and teaches at the University of Colorado, Denver.
They don't make any money from college football playoffs because they gave that up after Board of Regents, which was a financial mistake. They should have kept it. They're going to make a ton of money off the new contract for the women's March Madness in the new contract. But several of the commissioners have kind of made overtures and threats that they could leave, because what do you get from the NCAA if you're Ohio State or Alabama or Georgia? You're giving them a lot more than you receive, and so the question becomes, why remain apart? I could see the conferences potentially breaking off, especially the Power Five, and the NCAA has to be able to see that too.
If you heard a loud gulp from downtown Indianapolis just now, that'd be why. I can't say how likely a secession would really be. Setting up some kind of free state of football would be tricky. But the fact that that's anything more than an SEC fever dream says a lot. Groups like the Knight Commission, which does not exactly have a reputation as a wild bunch of radicals, are openly calling for a wholly new structure.
In 3 years, the CFP in its expanded format will bring in $2 billion annually. NCAA March Madness brings in $1 billion. So the CFP and its independent LLC will be the biggest pot of gold in college sports. And it sits outside of that NCAA structure. So that's a big change that's happening within the next 5 years. And that's why we believe, you know, it's time to create a new entity that is funded by the CFP, and that will, its sole focus will be on governing FBS football.
And even if there were to be a new structure, nobody quite knows where all this money will ultimately go. It could go where it's historically gone, supporting all the other programs in a given athletic department, or it could go to the athletes, whose sports are generating much of that revenue. That is the several billion-dollar question, because even as support grows for moving to the latter of those two models, many people worry about what else would happen if that comes to pass. And make no mistake, the NCAA does too. They would still like to have a say in what comes next. And they put themselves in a position to do that by doing what a lot of dying empires tend to do, with varying degrees of success. Try somebody new. Somebody really new. Someone unique. Let's call it a Hail Charlie.
At a moment in time where there is real transformation occurring in intercollegiate athletics, we are truly thrilled with this selection.
When you consider the priorities that we have right now in the NCAA, it's hard to imagine a better fit than Governor Baker.
He's not the same kind of leader that the NCAA has historically chosen. His only prior experience was playing basketball at Harvard. But credit the NCAA with the perspective to see that the old model, the 2010 Emmert, just wasn't fit for this race. They needed a 23 Baker, because this one's for all the marbles. And in less than a year at the wheel, Baker is already charting a historic new course. So we'll head on down to the track next time on The Option. The music you heard in this episode comes from Epidemic Sounds. Production and sound editing by Dean Metherill and Joe Engelbrecht. Cover art by Sam Ball. And I'm your host, Michael Hendricks. Catch you next time.